92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins. I'm sat here with my colleague Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And we're joined today by our very special guest, Colleen Murphy, known to nightclubbers the world over as DJ Cosmo. Welcome, Colleen.
Hello.
We'll be talking later about Lydia Lunch and featured writer Daryl Easley. But let's start with the main reason we've asked you to enter the Rocks Back Pages cupboard.
I love this cupboard. Which is, Mark, I feel very at home here, actually.
Tell us a little bit about specifically why we've asked.
The 14th of February this year is the 50th anniversary of David Mancuso's loft parties.
Yes.
You will be playing in New York at the 50th anniversary
one
party.
One of the people, yeah. I'm one of the musical guests.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say, Colleen, that you are sort of David Mancuso's representative on Earth?
I think there's a few people. I think one thing that's very important to say about the loft and David is that he didn't think the party was even just about him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about a sense of community. I'm one of the caretakers.
Right.
And that's how he would speak to me about it. And he considered himself a caretaker of the loft. I mean, it was very much, he said, like, the loft is a given name.
Yeah.
I should back up, because he started doing parties in his own home at 647 Broadway.
I just looked at a picture of it on Google Street View. It's still a fabulous building.
Yes.
I was just thinking what it must have been like.
But he started throwing informal parties in 1968, the year that I was born. And, you know, then he didn't really make them into proper weekly parties with a contribution until February 14th, 1970. And he called it a Love Saves the Day party.
Yes.
But then the loft was a given name because it was a loft. People are going, hey, are you going over there to that loft?
Yeah.
To the loft, the loft, the loft. And so it finally became the name of the party.
Yeah. Well, let's go. First of all, go back. When did you first start really getting the music? When did you start DJing?
Myself?
Yeah.
1982, when I was 14.
Wow.
I was quite lucky. I had a radio station in my high school right off the library. It was 10 watts. Got basically to the edges of my town, my small suburban New England town.
Right.
Where I was the only one that played music that wasn't top 40 and that wasn't classic rock. Although we did have one Christian music special, not my show. And I had a radio show for 4 years. So the first year I was actually playing 50s and 60s records because I was really into that. I was raiding my uncle's record collection at the time, and I had grown up. My parents didn't listen to a lot of music at home, but when we did listen to music in the car on a Sunday drive, we listened to people like Wolfman Jack, still had a syndicated radio show. Mm-hmm. And another one was Artie Woo Woo Ginsburg. Artie Woo Woo Ginsburg. And it was a syndicated show, and it was all like all those oldies songs, and I just knew them inside and out. And then my uncle lived down the street from me, and I used to go raid his record collection because I was given a GE Trimline record player, portable record player, hand-me-down when I was about 12.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I really started getting properly into albums. The first one was Moody Blues, Days of Future Past. That was my first obsession, actually, because it was a proper album.
Well,
I knew Knights in White Satin, and then
played
the whole album.
So is that the birth of classic album Sundays?
It really was. In my bedroom at the age of 12. And I never gave it back to my uncle. But then the following year, so my first year in high school, freshman year, I had that oldie show. The next year, I started to do more of an expansive kind of new wave show. So I was playing stuff like Elvis Costello, a lot of Elena Lovitch, B-52s, a little bit of hardcore stuff too that was kind of coming out. I was really into Black Flag and the Avengers and all sorts of like the DC scene. And then the following year, I had a show with my friend Mary Caruso called Punk, Funk, and Junk. Yeah. And that's where the name Cosmo was born, because she became Remix and I became Cosmo because there was a band, an electro band called Nucleus. and they had their DJ's name was Cosmo, and they say, "Yo, Cosmo, give me a beat." We had sweatshirts that we made with our names on the back. We rock around like, you know, our New England high school, you know, and no one else like really was into that music. So, and then my final year, I had a show called Strawberry Alarm Clock because I was still into 60s stuff. There was the whole kind of paisley pop thing that was going on. Yeah. And I was working at a record shop. It was this chain store at that time called Strawberries. Mm-hmm. And because I had a show in the morning, I worked at Strawberries. It was called Strawberry Alarm Clock. And that was a very eclectic show. Right. It could go from Strawberry Alarm Clock to Sade to Black Flag to, I mean, it was just whatever my fancy was. So, yeah, I think all 10 listeners loved it.
So how did you ease from there to sort of disco and kind of R&B and
well, it was a big trajectory. I mean, having said that, my first gig that I went to was the Funk Fest in Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. It was Gap Band, One Way, Grandmaster Melly Mel, and Bar Kays.
Fantastic.
And so I was also going to a few kind of electro-y clubs in Roxbury. Mm-hmm. I think my mom knows this. So, Mom, if you're listening, sorry. Yes,
you have to find out sooner or later.
You have to find out sooner or later. You know, I was into, of course, Prince, you know, and slept out for tickets for the Purple Rain tour. Right. She did find out about that later. She saw it on the news and she said, "So that's where Kalina's tonight, in the parking lot in Worcester, Massachusetts." So, but that was still, you know, and luckily in Boston, because I was outside Boston, we had great radio in Boston.
Right.
Because we had college radio stations.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, also Brown's station, too, in Providence, had a really good funk show as well.
Right.
And we had Kiss 108 with Sonny Joe White. Mm. So it was a commercial kind of, I hate saying the word black music, because I just don't think music has a color, but I'm just going to do it for simplicity's sake right now. And I used to listen to his show, too. So I was quite eclectic in my taste.
Sure.
But I wouldn't say that wasn't the music I was collecting.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was quite a trajectory because I moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
When did you move to New York?
1986.
86, okay.
And I went to NYU. And the reason I picked NYU is I had to get out of Boston. it had one of the best college radio stations in the country. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I knew that's where I wanted to be. And somehow we scrambled together loans and scholarships when I got there. Because I was the first kid in my family to go to university. It wasn't expected of me.
For sure.
And I went in the first week to WNYU station, said, "Hi, I want to work here." Mm. And that they became my, it was my family. It was my home right
Fantastic.
There. And I ended up becoming program director. Mm. And I did a whole bunch of radio shows there, including The Anchor Show, which was the new afternoon show, which is a 3.5 hour drive time show, where we played everything from like Nick Cave to all the Belgian stuff that was coming out,
yeah.
You know, the Cold Wave stuff to, you know, to the 4AD Cocteau Twins and Dead Can Dance to, you know, to punk, everything. So that was great. Mm. And then after that, I produced syndicated radio shows where I interviewed a lot of these bands, probably hundreds of bands, really, that was syndicated to, I think, 200 radio stations across the country, college radio stations. It was called Music View. And I would interview everyone, even like, you know, I was a huge Butthole Surfers fan at that time. I got to interview Paul Leary. I'd seen them like 15 times. And I mean, Nick Cave, loads of people. And then all the British stuff too, because I had always been an Anglophile, because growing up, I was really into New Order and Joy Division and the Smiths and seeing all these bands of The Cure. In fact, I danced on stage at one of the Smiths' legendary gigs in Boston. So I was really an Anglophile as well. So I was interviewing loads of bands like The Verve and Oasis and, you know, all these bands as well. But at the same time, I started going to David's parties.
We'll probably find Jim Sullivan's review of that show where she danced on the stage. And hopefully be some mention of
a
name
up.
Check.
I looked it up before because it was it's amazing. One thing that's amazing about the internet is you can find old set lists. I started listening to my first Grateful Dead show over and over last week. Someone turned me onto a site like March 22nd, 1987, the opening of the spring tour in Virginia Beach.
Wow.
Started listening to that. And you can find old track lists. And I found a photo of the Butthole Surfer show at the channel that I went to. I mean, it's amazing what you can find. So I did research. And the Smiths, that Smiths gig was quite a big one, actually. It was quite a famous Smiths gig. I think a lot of these, quote, we call them alternative bands now, or college radio bands, love playing in Boston because we had so many colleges they had great attendance. Yeah. It'd be like Boston and New York would be some of their best shows in L.A.,
So I interrupted you. You were starting to go clubbing as well.
I was hanging out in New York. I was mainly going to live shows. Mm-hmm. I was DJing a bit at CBGB's Record Canteen. Mm-hmm. I had played on the roof of Mars Club, because of WNYU. But my friend Adam Goldstone was bringing me out to various clubs around New York, including some of the early house clubs like Trax. And I always had a good time. Mm-hmm. I always had a really nice time, but it wasn't life-changing. Right. It wasn't like, I must buy these records and play these records and come to this place every week. And my last semester at NYU, I had just been living in Japan, actually, the semester before. I was a radio DJ in Japan. And I came back to New York, finished my last semester, and Adam brought me and my then boyfriend to a place called The Choice, which was on 3rd Street between Avenues B and C. It was a one-off party. I believe Larry Levan was playing.
Right.
And I knew nothing about this kind of music, so I wouldn't have known. He probably told me. Sadly, Adam's he's passed, sadly. But he had a huge impact on my life because he brought me to The Choice. And then I think I moved to San Francisco and traveled Central America, came back, produced these syndicated radio shows and rekindled my friendship with Adam. Or, we started hanging out again. And he said, oh, I want to bring you to this party. This must have been like 91 or 92. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's no record of any of this stuff, which is quite beautiful, isn't it? We don't have photos and we didn't record everything. We just lived. Mm. And it was the same space he had taken me to before as The Choice. And I, it was this old converted theater on 3rd Street between Avenues B and C. And it was still a rough neighborhood. I had lived in that neighborhood on 9th between B and C. In fact, that's where I lived when we went to The Choice that time. So it was fine for me. And I looked like a street urchin anyway. So I had no money. No one was ever going to bother me. And knock on the door. Someone lets you in. Okay, we pay $9.99. You give your $10 note, they give you a cent back. And then you go through the next set of doors and you check your coat for free. It was amazing. I was like, oh, okay. And I looked over and it was this huge room that had been, it was a former theater, so it had very high ceilings, but the floor had all been leveled out.
Right.
And it had these stacks, these huge speaker stacks all around the dance floor. Now I know they were Klipshorns.
Right.
I didn't know what they were at the time.
Right.
And then on one wall, the back wall, there was a kitchen set up. And then there's the musical hosting area. I'm not going to say the word DJ booth because David would zap me from musical heaven right now if I said that. But it's a place where the turntables were.
Right.
Behind the turntables was this man. I was probably 24 at the time, and he would have been 48 then, so 24 years apart, playing records very quietly, very introspectively, very beautifully, very musically. And the music I heard just blew me away because I was really into psychedelics and psychedelic records. And I had had a radio show.
I knew we had something in common. Yeah.
I had had a radio show in the late 80s called Plastic Tales from the Marshmallow Dimension. I kid you not. I chose that name. It used to be Mod Monday, and then I was like, no, I was getting to the long form, like proggy and also just psychedelic and garage rock stuff. So I was really into that kind of those records that really took you on a journey. I always had been, quite honestly. The Days of Future Past is my favorite, my first favorite album. That kind of just about sums it up, doesn't it? And the music that he was playing was dance music that evoked the same kind of feelings that these other records did.
Yeah.
It wasn't just functional music. And I'm not saying that house music is functional music, because it's not, but it can be.
Yeah.
There are some that are and some that aren't. Anything, like rock music or whatever.
Yeah.
But this his musical selection, of course, he's picking the best. Best records, records that have real proper life energy, that are wonderful from beginning to end, that are sonically well produced as well. So the sound system is shining, and the music is really shining because of the sound system, a real symbiotic relationship there. And I was actually, I bumped into a guy that I used to intern at Rockpool. And one of our reporting DJs happened to be there, John Hall. And he remembered me. And I kept asking him, what's this record? What's this record? What's this record? And I finally started doing some work with him, you know, helping him clean out his record collection. He was a record dealer.
Right.
And he had some records stored at David's. He had some records stored at Downstrax, where I later worked, where John was working at the time. And after my, you know, producing syndicated radio shows all day and interviewing bands like Oasis, I'd go and I'd be sorting through John's records, and him and Joe Clausel would be turning me onto records because I would work for records. And that's kind of how I started that record collection. And I started a radio show called Soul School back on WNYU because they asked me back. They actually needed DJs, strangely. So that's kind of how that happened. But that's kind of fast forwarding quite a bit. Going back to that experience that day, that particular night, it was really life-changing for me.
Sure.
I mean, it was someone's home.
Yeah.
At 5 in the morning, this was really trippy. At 5 in the morning, I was vegetarian. A vegetarian buffet is laid out. And I look up, and it's the woman who was cooking. I later found out, I think she'd been cooking like for decades for David. I used to work with her when I was waiting tables at a little cafe. I think it was called Home Sweet Home or something in Greenwich Village in the 80s. So it's just really strange, like all these weird, kind of weird connections.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was just blown away. I started going back every week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so through that process, you got to know David, eventually started hosting parties.
Well, basically, I wanted him to come up on my radio show because he was such an inspiration to me. And we'd kind of exchanged a few words, but I was, you know, someone's playing records. I'm not running up and...
Sure.
I think we had shared a taxi once because he used to go back up to Mount Tremper. He had a house up there. And so he'd go there for half the week. So he's originally from Utica, New York, and then moved to New York City in his, I believe, late teens. But he had a place up there. And so that's why the song City Country City by War was so important
that's
to
really
him as well. So he'd spend half the week up there.
Right.
And I lived on 30th between 8th and 9th by this time. And I would just sometimes jump in the cab on his way up to the Port Authority. But I really wanted him to come to my radio show, but he had never played records outside of his own home, you know? So my friend John Hall made a more formal introduction, and he said, let's see me hanging around. And he said, let's go out for a drink. So he and I went out, and we started talking about musical synchronicity. And music, for me, has always been that way. I'll be thinking about something and then it appears in a record shop or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, like just that kind of connection. And even when I was doing the radio, I'd have something queued up, not even playing yet. And someone would call up and request that song that I have queued up.
Yeah.
And similarly, if I was on the dance floor at David's Loft, I would think, oh, it'd be great if you played this song next. And he would, you know. So we talked about that. I mean, there was already a connection.
Yeah, yeah,
so he came up, did my radio show, never spoke, just chose the records because he was too shy. And then I don't know how many weeks later or months, but he then said, hey, do you want to play some records with me? And I was like, yeah. And I think I listened to my entire record collection and I played 4 records. But you have no headphones.
Right.
Because of the, you know, here he was. I had heard about these famed Quetsu cartridges that cost like $2,000 each. I mean, now they're $6,000 each, these particular ones. But, and here is David asking me to, like, trusting me to even handle the sound system at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And also the dancers, because these are the cream of the crop dancers of New York. And these are the people that really know this music inside and out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he's trusting me with all of this. And
pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I asked him years later, I asked him actually just before he stopped traveling, he was in our back garden. He used to come to our house like 4 times a year when we were doing the Lucky Cloud parties. And I said, you know, I think back now that I know all this stuff about audio equipment and high-end audio and moving coil cartridges, and I knew nothing back then.
Mm-hmm.
So that, why did he even trust me to even handle the equipment or even with the dancers? And he said, It starts with a vibe long before one hits the turntable. Yeah. So anyways, it came up, you know, then I was playing little sets if he needed a break.
Sure.
Or a few, and I had even filling in for him on occasion if he, so the party was every week. So, and then, you know, it was a really difficult time for David in the 90s. He thought he had bought that building on East 3rd Street through a lawyer. And he, it was the first time he was actually going to own his own building.
Right.
You know, and he was just, you know, he'd been, gentrification had kind of gotten him out of Soho. All these artists wanted to make money with real estate.
Yes.
They didn't want all these black people and gay people hanging around
Absolutely,
outside.
Yeah.
He knew the end was near. And so he purchased this building on 3rd Street, had the work done. But he had purchased it through a lawyer, and he gave that lawyer power of attorney. And so by the time, in the 90s, you know, by the time I'm meeting him and kind of hanging out with him and hanging out with him during the week and playing records at a group he called the Music Pool and just starting my friendship with him, things were rough. I mean, they were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds out that, you know, he doesn't own the building.
Oh, God.
And now we're starting, this is a starting the time of gentrification in the East Village as well. So he, you know, he was moving to progressively smaller spaces.
Mm-hmm.
The next one was Avenue A and then Avenue B. Mm-hmm. We were doing fundraising parties. He had lost a lot of his crowd that used to go to the famous Prince Street venue, which was the big one. It
right.
could hold 1,500 people.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was in Alphabet City.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah.
You know, it was a heroin area.
Yes,
it was rough, you know.
Absolutely.
It was really rough. And he lost a lot of people. Other people had moved on and grown up, apparently. And, you know, had kids and moved to the suburbs and maybe weren't around as much either. But a lot of people just didn't want to go there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then he goes to these progressively smaller venues where then he's now renting again. So you're subject to the landlord. You're subject to gentrification. You're subject to noise. Although it was never that noisy because he always kept it at a good level. But I just found his file of all these, you know, kind of, you know, fundraising invitations that he would do. And yeah, it was an intense time for him. And it didn't look like a lot of people just kind of left him, in, you know, and there were only a core group of people that were really, including myself, that were really trying to help him, you know.
I mean, it's worth sort of going back a bit to sort of talk about the importance of the loft itself. I mean, a lot of people would say that that is disco ground zero.
Yeah.
There's some truth in that. There's a broader conversation around to be had about that. What is absolutely certain is just about every single key DJ of the disco period and afterwards from New York had experienced the loft, the Larry Levans of this world.
Frankie Knuckles,
Tony Humphries,
Dan Morales, everyone. You know.
Absolutely. So their introduction to this sort of way of playing dance music was via David Mancuso, which makes him an incredibly important person.
And yet,
yeah.
it's so unusual as well.
Totally
reading,
unusual.
So the three pieces that we're featuring this week, one is a shortish piece by Frank Broughton, and one is a longer piece by Greg Wilson. You just sort of think, for someone so influential on the path of dance music through the 70s, he was never a typical kind of DJ. Really,
he was a hippie.
He
wasn't a hippie. He was a musical host.
He kind of hung out with Timothy Leary, done a lot of psychedelics, and had this very, you know, spiritual attitude towards playing records in that context.
That's exactly, I think, one of the reasons I got so turned on as well, because I had just studied Zen Buddhism in Japan, you know, and I was really open-minded to all this stuff. But he didn't start these parties, you know, to become a DJ. I mean, that didn't really exist. You had Francis Grasso at the Sanctuary.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then this is the late 60s as well.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
people are turning up to Davis Loft as his home without making any financial contribution around the same time. And these were venues that people went to purely to dance.
Yeah.
Because you have to remember, discotheques at this time were still places where people had to go and wear a suit.
That's
it was
right.
a little dance floor at a restaurant.
Based on the French model.
Exactly.
Based on the French model. It was all about being seen.
Yeah.
You might have a little boogie, but it wasn't about, I'm going to go and lose my head just dancing.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, and like maybe almost taking that kind of ethos of the Grateful Dead, you know, where you go and lose your head and just dance to the Grateful Dead. It's like taking that to a dance floor of pre-recorded music.
Yeah, yeah.
So no one was really doing this. So this is this is the foundation of what we now call club culture or whatever. Although his wasn't a club, it was a party. And he, you know, started the financial contributions because he didn't want to have to work anymore. People are coming to his house. It was 1970. He inaugurates these parties based on the Harlem rent parties in the 1920s because, you know, African Americans weren't allowed to go to so many places, so they threw their own parties.
That's right.
Called rent parties, they could pay for their rent.
Yep.
And,
yep.
and that's what he was trying to do. You know, I'll just see if I can pay my rent this way. And he was able to. So he didn't start it to, you know, become a superstar. He actually started it for a sense of community. And he was really into social progress and social inclusivity. Kind of these key words that we see today. He was doing this in the late 1960s and 1970s.
Blacks, gays, whites, everyone on the dance floor. In a kind of union, the community of the dance floor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think even more importantly, economic parity.
Yeah.
I find that's where we have the biggest divisions, is these so-called economic class divisions. Almost more than race and sexual preference and gender. And that still goes to this day. I find so liberating. You know, and you could have all different types of people from all different backgrounds. And he was really into promoting that kind of social evolution in a way where people self-police themselves. So it was members, and you could bring friends, a certain number of friends, but the membership wasn't paid for.
Right.
And this is what he really had a problem with like the Paradise Garage, even though he was friends with Larry, and Larry was kind of a protege of his. He didn't like the fact that he had started this members thing just because he had to make it a private party so people were able to do what they wanted to do. He didn't sell alcohol. And it was a financial contribution.
So
it was an invitation.
Laced with LSD, I seem to remember.
Yeah, it was free, though.
Well, we're going to have to move on very, very shortly.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got to say, first of all, that Colleen, is that you are my absolute favourite DJ.
Oh,
I mean,
thank you.
I came to parties very late in life. I was a middle-aged raver. I remember the very first time I met you, you were doing a back-to-back with Bill Brewster at the upstairs room in Fabric.
Oh, wow.
You won't remember this. And there was nothing snottier than the DJ booth at Fabric. There'd be a lot of people doing coke, and it was all very arrogant and so on and so forth. She was picking up a record from her bag, and she walked towards the turntables and turned around and looked at me and just beamed at me. And it was like the first act of generosity I'd ever felt in the DJ booth at Fabric. And I used to go quite regularly along the bill. And so that had quite an impression. So I've been very lucky to have seen this woman play a number of times.
And you've also been to Classic Album Sundays.
I've only been to one because it's Sundays, and that's when I look after my daughter.
Which one did you come to?
Oh, I can't remember what it was. I didn't come to
It wasn't Days of Future Past.
No, I guess not. It wasn't In a Silent Way, because that's one of your favourite albums.
No, I'd love to come to that. And I'd love to come to the Electric Ladyland.
So that's 10 years old as well, isn't it?
10 years this year.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I really can't believe it. We're
marking that anniversary too.
I know. We're going to have to do something big.
And that you and others, like the Lucky Cloud guys, that have introduced this country, the culture of the clipped-on speaker, the monoblock, valve amplifiers, not even DJ turntables sometimes, since that Torrance, proper hi-fi turntables and all that. And I think we've all learnt that the listening experience can be so much better than the standard club, you know, banging noise. We'd better skip on, haven't we?
Skip.
Time is hurtling by.
Fantastic. Time does tend to hurtle by when we're recording our podcast. But, I mean, that was fantastic. Really loved hearing you talk about your journey.
Yeah, and have a fabulous time on the 14th, the party you're playing on the
14th. I will. Actually, the party itself is going to be on the 16th. I'm actually going to do a Cosmodelica night on the 14th at Public Records, which is a nice hi-fi. But the party, because we host them on a Sunday
of
now.
Of course, yes.
It's going to be the 16th.
Right.
It's private, so.
Where in New York is the event on the 16th?
It's in the East Village.
In the East Village.
Yeah.
Great.
So
fantastic.
On the 16th. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. So, free on the homepage this week are two pieces about David Mancuso, and also a piece about you.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Written by whom?
Lulu LeVay.
The wonderful name, that was the first article written about me here when I moved over. Yeah.
Well, delights that we have it on RBP. It is from 1999.
Yeah, I moved here in February. I moved here the day after.
You only just moved. I think it says that.
21 years ago. And my last party that I played at was, I played at David's 29th anniversary and moved here the next day.
Wow.
It says, the intro is, the Stanford says, she was a mainstay of New York nightlife until Mayor Giuliani sent in the cops.
Yeah. Giuliani. See, I was right. I was right about him, wasn't I?
You were right then. You're even more right now.
Exactly.
Oh, my. Oh, my. also free on the homepage are three pieces by the aforementioned Daryl Easley, who's great book about chic, Everybody Dance, is actually being reissued this week in revised form. Chic and the Politics of Disco is the... Yeah, so it all kind of knits together.
I've been through Niall a couple of times, and I loved how he considered his music more art pop. And those early chic covers are modeled on Roxy Music covers. Interesting.
That whole chic element was very influenced by Roxy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they were so fascinating. One of the three pieces, actually, that I've chosen is a piece about a record they did with Norma Jean Wright, her solo record on, of all labels, Bearsville.
That's the only disco record
that Albert Grossman ever put his name to. But it does include the fabulous anthem Saturday, which is one of Chic's greatest works.
I just love that
song. And I learned, reading Daryl's piece, that actually Saturday was a track that they were playing long before Chic was born.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mm. And then they kind of slightly tweaked it for Norma Jean, who was the original Chic singer. And it's one of my absolute favourite disco records.
Now it's in my head.
Yes, it is one of those sort of transcendental, euphoric disco tracks that also it's got a kind of undertow of melancholy about it.
It does.
Which is what Chic has, I think.
But it's also, I think, the African-American experience at that time, too. So a lot of people are working these crap jobs all week. And maybe not just African-Americans either, but, you know, and then on the weekend is when they can really let loose and be themselves.
I mean, they were such great lyricists. They were.
Yeah,
the lyric of Saturdays is just gorgeous. So there's that. And then also a very long piece attempting to defend to some degree Elvis Presley, the actor.
That's a tough mission.
He actually quotes this hilarious thing from Elvis in 63. I've had intellectuals tell me that I've got to progress as an actor and explore new horizons. I'd like to progress, but I'm smart enough to realize you can't bite off more than you can chew in this racket. You can't go beyond your limitations, especially if you're managed by Colonel Tom Parker. I love the idea of intellectuals telling Elvis that he needs to do something a bit artier.
Hey, Elvis, stop reading Cage's cinema.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Goddard wants to work with you. So that's a great little piece.
Goddard did work with the Rolling Stones, so you know it was not a massively.
It is
the worst Goddard movie of the lot.
Yeah, well, indeed. And then just briefly, this is a bit of lateral thinking on my part. Daryl's sleeve notes for a full compilation called 50,000 Fall Fans Can't Be Wrong.
That's fantastic. That's great.
It's a great guide to the best Fall tracks between 78 and 2003. So we love Daryl. Daryl's been on RBP for a number of years. He's absolutely delightful, wonderful writer. So enjoy those too. And at this point, Colleen, we start talking about what isn't free on Rock's Back Pages. And Mark will tell us about this week's audio interview.
Yeah, it's Martin Aston interviewing the fabulous Lydia Lunch in the winter of 89. She's actually in England doing a spoken word tour. So most of the interview is actually essentially about the difference between singing and spoken word and so on and so forth. I mean, she's ranting. I mean, even in the interview. I mean, Aston's obviously kind of pinned back in his seat by her as she kind of like bellows away. She talks about censorship, about having her films destroyed. She's very contentious. I mean, very interestingly, she talks about women encouraging their own abuse, and she talks about how she was abused herself by her father. and how therapy has been useful to her. And she talks about being on the margins and not caring that she's on the margins and not caring that she's not in the mainstream. We'll listen to a clip about exactly that now.
I don't want to go into the mainstream in order to... I don't care about subverting, perverting, corrupting. It doesn't... I don't care. All I need is enough to get by. I have such a moderate lifestyle, and I just need to be able to escape from New York when I need to escape. And that's it. I don't really care. The money, I don't want the trap. The more money you have, the more you spend, the more taxes you have to pay. What does that matter? What does that mean? I like to move every few years. I can't get fill the trunks, the U-Hauls, ship it out. I don't know. It doesn't mean anything. Marginal? Yeah, I mean, margin. I'd like to think I was not even in the ballpark, you know. I'm so far off the mark, I'm on the next stratosphere.
Every man's madness, and I'm hurling the core. There's knives in my dream, empty splints in my brain.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, that sort of keys in with what we're talking about David Mancuso. Absolutely. In a way, he had no desire to be in the mainstream, and he had the same problems that she has, that you just got to make enough money just to sort of go from one place to the next.
Absolutely. And
she talks about spoken word, particularly in relation to people like Henry Rollins, who had also done all the spoken word stuff, and Karen Finley, who you mentioned before we started the podcast. She says that Karen Finley has also made records. She says she really shouldn't. She's terrible.
I keep telling her not to.
Yeah. She talks to some extent about her music and about how she actually, it was writing lyrics which led her to music, not the other way around. She talks about hating political music. You know, basically people can't, you can't join the two things together. And actually, I think we broadly agree. There are very, very few good, effective political songs. I mean, you can count Morris in the finger of one hand. She talks a lot about her audiences and the nature of the conflict, especially as a spoken word artist, the conflict that she'd run into. She talks about feminism and pornography, all kinds of stuff. Mm. I mean, it's over an hour, but she packs a lot in, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah, she does. She reminded me more than anyone of Madonna, funnily enough, in the way she talks. She's got no self-doubt. She's absolutely kind of relentless in her kind of ideas. And I mean, very, very impressive. I mean, I knew Lydia a bit back in the days of Nick Cave and the Birthday Party, who you mentioned earlier. Lydia was over here a lot in that era and collaborating with members of the Birthday Party. And in fact, that's the reason for the audio, is that she's in town here in London next week, taking part in an evening at the Royal Festival Hall to celebrate the life and music of Roland Howard of the Birthday Party. I mean, I knew Roland really well, and he would be very tickled to think that the Royal Festival Hall was hosting. You know, it's like, well, those guys were like back then. It was a million miles away from the Royal Festival Hall. But Lydia was around, and I mean, I was always really impressed by Lydia. I got along with her. She was sort of kept this whole insane drug craze scene at arm's length. You know, she didn't do heroin. She didn't do those drugs. She always seemed to be pretty together.
She's
to me.
Very together, yeah.
Yeah, very together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never knew quite what to make of her. And I can't say I've sort of loved all her work, but I think clearly she's been a very important force.
She was really inspiring to me, too. Like in the 1980s, when I moved to New York City, there were places like the gas station. Richard Kern showed his films there. Mm-hmm. And I saw, I think Lydia was in one of them. And then also, I saw Lydia perform at this place. I think it was called Sybarite or something. It was definitely on the margins of Manhattan at that time, the meatpacking district. And her and Karen Finley, I remember catching both of them. Mm-hmm. And they were just very inspiring to young women.
Yes.
I mean, just this fact that they really didn't care what people thought of them. They were really pushing forward in terms of feminism, I think, in a very much more unorthodox way.
Yes.
Like maybe, you know, employing different kind of pornographic kind of angles that other feminists from yesteryear may have thought was unfeminist.
Well, she goes into that to some extent in this interview. She talks about, because there's that group, Women Against Pornography, which is Andrew Dworkin and people like that, and how she was constantly getting to rouse with them.
Yeah.
You know, that you're right, her feminism was powerful but unorthodox yes. in that sort of sense.
She's very brave. I mean, she's never been in it to kind of, you know, win friends and influence. And she's pretty candid about that in this audio. But she doesn't really care whether feminists like her, and she doesn't really care whether misogynists like her, you know.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't even really care if audiences don't like her. But,
anybody likes her. Yeah, I mean, I always did feel that with her. And yeah. I mean, I kind of probably felt that night. So it was actually Lester Bangs who introduced me to the plangent sounds of Teenage Jesus and the Germs.
Yeah. plangent wow. sounds.
The only time I met Lester went to his scuzzy apartment on 6th Avenue, and he just essentially sort of regaled me with tales of no wave bands and played all these virtually unlistenable records. But he was just so infatuated with Lydia and, you know, Mars and DNA and James Chance and that whole scene was just so vibrant then. It's been called No Wave Vibrant. But I kind of thought, I mean, Lydia is one of the great interviews in many ways. I mean, the early interviews that we have on the site from like New York Rocker, she's brilliant to read.
She's also made some very listenable, terrific records.
Well, Queen of Siam, we love.
Queen of Siam,
which criminally is not on Spotify.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was. Someone's removed it.
It was. Maybe Michael Zilker of Z.
But no, she's an endearingly fascinating person, you know, and I really loved the No Wave stuff because I really didn't much like English post-punk. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the idea of English post-punk, and let's mention at this point the death of Andy Gill last week.
Yeah,
and Gang of Four. Gang of Four were a band I always liked the idea of far more than the actual reality of listening to them. I mean, I thought he was a fantastic guitar player.
He was the ultimate kind of post-punk guitar player, wasn't he? Because there was funk in there, but in this very kind of angry, atonal sort of way.
I just struggled to get past John King's kind of polemical vocals. I'm talking about political music, you know. That I struggled with Gang of Four. But he was a great guitar player. But so English post-punk to some extent drove into the arms of No Wave and also into the arms of black music, and which I'd always loved, but suddenly listening to kind of, you know, Eddie Kendricks or something was a lot more promising than listening to sort of moaning English people.
Yeah.
I better get on with what's going to the library, hadn't I?
Absolutely.
Should I?
Go on.
Permission granted.
Go on.
Well, first thing is... Peter Jones transcribes it, but it's actually presented as Georgie Fame chats with Mick Jagger for Record Mirror, 6th of November, 65. And they're basically talking about the English R&B scene. Jagger comes up with some really odd stuff, as usual. He says, at the moment, there's too much reliance placed on American stars. You get sick of the scene where people seem to think that a coloured American R&B artist is better than a British one simply because he is a coloured American. Ours are just as good. Just compare Chris Farlow's version of In the Midnight Hour with Wilson Pickett's and you've got the answer.
I love it. Well, you know, Mick would say that, really, wouldn't you? I mean, considering, you know, he's actually... cribbed his whole vocal style, if not his actual voice from Don Covey.
Quite.
You know, who needs the real Don Covey when you've got me?
I mean, you know, it's pretty hilarious stuff. Moving forward to the LA Times, Richie York interviewing Jimi Hendrix in 69. And this is actually kind of sad, because if you read interviews with Jimi Hendrix from mid-late 68 onwards, you're hearing a man who's really quite depressed and who's finding life a real struggle. This, at the point, is criminally badly managed. I mean, say that Jimi Hendrix was one of the worst managed artists in rock and roll history, the lovely Mike Jeffries. And so he says things like, you know, when you first make it, the demands on you are very great. For some people, they're just too heavy. And our great friend Keith Altham was his publicist in 67 and so on. And everyone I knew who met him in 67 in London said he was just delightful. He was the happiest man on earth, you know. And then you start reading his interviews in around 69, and this is an exhausted guy. I mean, he's just been flogged around.
Worked to death.
Worked to
two
death.
Two albums in 1 year, and then a double album.
And touring.
Touring. One of the biggest international touring artists at the time,
wasn't he? Absolutely. And did he see any of that money? No, apparently it's all in a Swiss bank account that only Mike Jeffries, who died in a plane crash, had access to. Oh, yeah.
So if anyone's got the code to that.
He says you've got to know much more than just the techniques of notes. You've got to know sounds and what goes between the notes. I mean, he's
and
right.
Miles Davis.
You know, exactly. You know, it's an interesting interview. It's a sad interview. Around 69, he started getting reports of this a man who's losing his temper a lot. He famously beat up a groupie in a hotel room once. Now, this is a man who liked women. Mm. You know, this is not Jimi Hendrix as he was, you know, this is what he became as a result of just being going from festival to the Winterland to another hall, zigzagging across America, playing the same old bloody tunes, you know, and just it did him in. You know.
There's also a quote from that piece that I think you put on the Facebook page, which I pulled out on the homepage just because it seems timely that he's saying this is 69. There's a great need for harmony between man and earth. I think we're really screwing up that harmony by dumping garbage in the sea, air pollution, and all that stuff. Well, that's all got a lot better, hasn't it? But there we go, Jimmy, ecologist.
This next one's Rob Partridge interviewing a man called Dave McAllier, who ran a label called Disco Demand, who were Pi Records' Northern Soul imprint. And they discovered that they could find these obscure records in America, repress them here, and sell thousands of copies to the North. He says, the reaction from people at Roulette was very strange. Roulette being one of the labels.
Oh,
right?
Morris Levy. I worked for him. He owned Strawberries.
Oh, right.
I went to his estate a few times.
Did
and
you?
I had a few interactions with him.
Well, we have to do a separate episode.
Oh, my
separate
gosh.
Episode of can you come back
Morris
next week?
My first boss.
Says the reaction from people at Roulette was very strange. You guys want the B-sides to flop records? You're nuts. But the Casualiers have sold more records, now sold more records in Britain than they ever did in the States.
The Casualiers.
I love that. Nick Kent interviewing Elvis Costello in 78. Ooh. Now, 1978, Elvis Costello's in his pomp. This is Model had just been released. Mm. And he'd already got his reputation as this really spiky, difficult individual.
Angry young bank clerk.
And he says, you know, I don't necessarily think I'm going to become a nicer person or a more complete person as a consequence of all of this. I may not be mature because I just may not fucking want to be. I don't know what being grown up is, see? And I could never imagine a lot of people wanting this ugly geek in glasses ramming his songs down their throats. And that's exactly what I'm in it for. I'm in it to disrupt people's lives. I mean, it's great stuff. Nick Kent had famously done one of the very first interviews about the year before.
You mentioned Costello earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm always, given the context of this being Rock's Back Pages, I'm always reminded of that great David Lee Roth quote, which is the reason why rock critics love Elvis Costello and hate Van Halen is because they all look like Elvis Costello.
That's fantastic.
That's great. I've never heard that quote before.
He was something very different.
Because
even some of the punk bands were not sort of ugly, quote unquote. And he kind of made no attempt to sort of, you know, look cool or anything. Yeah. He was like this. I mean, he had worked as a bank clerk, hadn't he?
Yes,
I mean, in America, I mean, you mentioned him earlier. And
he was quite underground, but when I started listening to him, it was his lyrics.
Yeah.
And, you know, great and, you know, memorable hooks and melodies, of course, and very concise. And he did that thing called groove jamming where he'd have all these different songs. He was so prolific. I mean,
there's
so many songs on these records, like Get Happy and everything. Yeah. But his lyrics were really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
were just great. And it took you, I don't know, they just kept giving.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like I mentioned with his curmudgeonly kind of persona being like, you know, Van Morrison too. Now, although their trajectories and what they sing about is very different, again, Van Morrison's music to me is a music that keeps on giving. I just keep finding more and more. And Joni and Mitchell, I think certain people. Elvis was
I'm not a lyrics person. Mm-hmm. You know, the world does some divide into people who listen to lyrics and those who don't. And I'm not sure I know the words to a single song, complete song. You know,
not even Bridge Over Troubled Water.
But I did always like Elvis. Also, I mean, I saw him quite a few times back around that time, around 79, 80, 81. And I saw him at the Brighton Dome, I think 80. Not the Dome, Brighton Centre. And it was one of the electrifyingly good rock and roll shows I ever saw.
They were pretty great. You know,
they came running on stage. They were lit from beneath, so their shadows were like German expressionist movies cast up to the ceiling. Yeah. Were ramming into the first song. And like, bang, 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 bang. Mm. And then they did a really straight version of One Day I'll Fly Away, you know, the Randy Crawford song. They did it absolutely straight. And you could see all the audience, half the, and which I loved, because I loved that record. And you see all the audience going, what's he doing this for?
Sure. But of course, it was a clue to the many different directions that he would go in. I mean, interesting, the quote about him not, you know, I don't want to grow up or whatever that quote was. I mean, actually, I think he did grow up.
Yeah.
And
not necessarily to good effect.
Well, no, but I think, you know, I feel respect for Elvis, even though it's very hit or miss. I mean, he will try on so many different hats, and sometimes it works. A lot of the time you think, why are you putting that hat on?
Yeah, but I like the country stuff that he was kind of leaning into that.
I like
the
that
late
album.
80s.
Yeah, yeah. I like that album a lot.
It's beautiful.
Darling, there is one thing I must tell you, you must know. It's so hard to say the words I feel.
Next one is Gary Bushell goes to the Lewisham Odeon to see the Specials, the Selector, and a very early version of Dexys Midnight Runners live. This is Gary Bushell, who's since developed his reputation as this fairly horrendous right-wing columnist for The Sun and The Star and so on and so forth.
But a valued contributor to
Rock Chat Nation. He says, the lovely bouncing...
I have to just say that.
He says, the lovely bouncing Pauline, that's Pauline's Selector, got uptight at the usual arm exercises of a small German movement turnout who didn't suss how ridiculous they looked, showing their enjoyment via Sieg Heils to a mostly black band playing mostly black music. I mean, that was a real thing at the time. Those bands, the two-tone bands,
the skinhead,
the skinhead following was a nightmare. I just find, you know, that 2 years after this, Bushell was promoting Oi music, which was pretty ostentatious, you know, notably right-wing sort of skinhead.
Did Dexys get much of a mention in this review?
They don't.
Because their first single was actually on two-tone, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was.
It
may well have been.
Even though pretty quickly they diverged from that movement.
He's fairly rude about them as being sort of just kind of bad Stax repro, but he didn't see much commercial future for them.
That's great.
1988, John Hazlewood interviewing Was Not Was.
Oh, fantastic.
For Number One magazine, which of course means it's kind of fairly flippant. Interestingly, David Was does most of the talking. Don really doesn't have much to say, but David was the lyricist for the band, I think, so it kind of makes sense. And he says, we really respect Bruce Willis and his burgeoning singing career. Actually, I've had up to here with him, especially when he advertises wine coolers and then tries to be rootsy. Should he wear a hat to cover his baldness? He should wear a noose. could I just mention, I love the Ayatollah and his wife, the Ayatollette, who works in the Ayatollah booth. that outfit he wears, geez, I played golf with him in 1981 on our Tyrants tour. I was held hostage and had to clean his balls, which I did with a little detergent and gunpowder. Golf balls, of course.
This is hysterical. Because Don Was would never say things like
no.
that. And Don Was probably just pulled his punches, didn't he? Yeah. Because he sort of knew he wanted to be a big-name producer, which David Was never quite became.
I don't give a desire to, actually.
He did produce a couple of... He produced the Ricky Lee Jones album.
Oh, did he?
Which album? It was called Pop Pop. Oh. And it was it was sort of covers of kind of torchy jazz songs.
Okay.
But he never seemed that interested in the way that Don...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Don Was became a hugely successful
Absolutely.
Producer.
And record exec.
And record exec.
Well, indeed.
I am a spy in the house of love.
This interview would have been actually when I met him, because we did a TV show, my band did a TV show in 88.
And Was Wrong.
Yeah. And we were doing our terrible version of Crazy. And Don Was came up to me afterwards and said, I love all that Reggie Young parallel force shit you're playing, you know, which is pretty good. They were great to hang around with in the TV studio.
I bet they were.
Because when they were just doing run-throughs. They were just funny. They were done, yes, like, their guitar player would play a solo and do a somersault in the air while playing a solo. They had this woman percussionist who was just fantastic. And Sweet Pea Atkinson chilled me to the bone. I kind of went up raving, oh, Sweet Pea, you know, I really love all this stuff. And I said, how are you doing? He said, it gets old and it gets tired.
And of course, they were on Z as well, so there's that sort of, you know, tenuous Lydia Lunch connection, because Queen of Siam was on Z.
That's a great
fascinating label.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Incredible,
yeah,
label. Strutted a nice
You knew Zilker.
I knew Zilker a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Mr. Mothercare.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Mothercare. He's now like a squillionaire who I think made money out of oil in like Houston. And I mean, how you get from Alan Vega to...
I did Alan Vega at my kitchen table. That was one of the... Yeah, he was an interesting man.
Yeah,
oh, my wonderful. Gosh. Not what I expected whatsoever.
He was such a nice, good sweetheart,
nice,
wasn't he?
Chris Needs, who we had in as guest while back, was a great friend of his.
And wrote the suicide book.
And every time I read about suicide, everyone ends up falling a little bit in love with Alan Vega.
Yeah.
There was something really, really sweet about him.
When you kind of... when you grew up looking at listening to Frankie Teardrop, you kind of just assumed this guy was like psycho. But he really wasn't. He was a gentle soul.
And a great Elvis impersonator.
Great Elvis impersonator.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know. Anyway, lastly, from my stuff is May 98. Sean O'Hagan goes to Northern Ireland with you two. They're going to play a concert celebrating the imminent Good Friday Agreement, or promoting the yes vote for it. And Sean O'Hagan's reporting for The Observer is just fabulous. He's such a good journalist. He says, I'm sure I hear Bono and David Trimble discussing the musical merits of Amazing Grace. Then Bono says something like, it's amazing that the evangelical tradition can throw up such disparate campaigners as Martin Luther King and Dr. Paisley. David Trimble nods his head and he says, I never thought about it like that before, but I suppose it's pretty amazing, all right. Then Bono says, I often wonder if Ian Paisley reads his Bible but skips over all the bits about grace and forgiveness. David Trimble laughs and says, no, Ian's not very big on forgiveness. it's a terrific report. A few weeks back, we put Sean O'Hagan's piece where he interviewed the Undertones drummer about growing up during the Troubles and so on and so forth.
Mm.
Subsequent to that, I met Raymond Gorman, that Petrol Emotion, Kev Hopper's New Year's Day thing, and we ended up talking at great length about that, about what it was like as a kind of Catholic schoolboy in Derry. Raymond Gorman went on the 68. He was seven. He went on the 68. Wow. March, which was broken up by the police with tear gas and all that sort of stuff,
really?
the Civil Rights March. It's just, you know, and Sean O'Hagan, he's from there, isn't he, I believe. He's certainly Irish.
Northern Irish.
Right. He writes about all of that really, really well, you know, in a really kind of personal sort of way.
Mm.
So that's my lot. You got anything to talk about?
Just mentioning a couple of things that I enjoyed. One was a piece about the late, great Vivian Stanshall.
Uh-huh.
From 2004, is Rob Chapman writing about Vivian's first solo album and just paying tribute to his unruly comic genius. That's enjoyable. There's a Primal Scream piece from 2000 by Dorian Linsky, who was on the podcast last week, which is, as you might imagine from that era, it's you know, essentially all about heroin.
I interviewed him at that time as well.
Did
was
you?
When the Screamadelica was released in Sire. And I was doing these syndicated radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything was audio. It wasn't just transcribing. So here on America, I mean, we have to remember, we had subtitles for Trainspotting. So we had all these glass regions, and I didn't have my own studio, so we didn't all have separate mics. It's one little mic.
Right.
I was up at, you know, 75 Rockefeller. And I have the entire band, all leaning about 17 feet away from the microphone and on the nod with Glaswegian accents.
Did you have subtitles?
I somehow produced a show, but then I interviewed them right after that. They were coming back up from Memphis and when they had been recording down there.
Give out,
and
it was but don't give up.
Yeah, and they were a different band. Bobby was just on fire. They were completely happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've interviewed him again over the years, you know, for Six Music and then for another event. And he's lovely, lovely guy.
Well, he's also taking part in this Roland Howard event.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, so there was that. And Jasper has actually added a Teenage Jesus and the Jerks review, which is quite timely. And then the other thing I quite enjoyed was a piece about Them Crooked Vultures, which, as many of you will know, was a supergroup consisting of Josh Homme and Dave Grohl and John Paul Jones. And it was this sort of...
Sounds ghastly.
No, there was... It was pretty good, actually. Okay. It was pretty good. I mean, if you're a Queens fan, if you're a Zep fan...
I'm a Queens fan. You know, I'm a Zep fan.
I thought, yeah. I didn't think it got the attention that it should have done. Did you, hear
I
that
never,
record
I didn't
at all?
Hear that, no.
Do you know, it's a pretty decent record. I don't think those three guys could... put together make a bad record. And while it's not Songs for the Deaf or Led Zeppelin 4, it's still a pretty kind of creditable supergroup effort. And then lastly, there's a piece about Sister Rosetta Tharpe from 2018,
which is,
I mean, it's a retrospective piece, obviously. The good sister was long departed at this point, but it's a really nice piece. David Burke, the writer, talks to people who knew her.
Yeah.
And what an extraordinary kind of pioneer she was.
Absolutely.
If for nothing else, just playing a white Gibson SG in the 50s.
Actually, as a guitar player, she's incredibly important because without her, you don't get Chuck Berry. Mm. His style is straight out of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. That I think Jasper's indicating that we should shut the fuck up.
It's Jasper waving. Jasper's waving from across the room.
Do we have a guest next week?
We don't have a guest.
So it's going to be the power trio, is it?
It's just the three of us. So next week is the week of Valentine's Day, and we've been talking about Love Saves the Day. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about The Loft. We've just absolutely enjoyed having you as our guest. So much today.
Fabulous.
Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For
Thanks for the
coming
invitation.
In from Hackney.
All the way from Hackney.
And, you know, enjoy the 50th anniversary celebrations
I
in
will.
New York and
we
wherever
will.
Else you're marking that event. And come back and see us sometime and talk to us about Morris Levy.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
We're going to go out with another clip from Lydia Lunch, where she talks about lyrics and music and so on and so forth. It's all good stuff. We'll see you next week.
See you then. Bye.
We had a date, 12th Street and 8th.
Well, the lyrics were the thing that started me creating in a musical format. I didn't know at 17 or wasn't interested when I started Teenage Jesus to just get in the direct verbal route. Also, the lyrics dictated the music. You know, the rhythm of the lyrics dictated the music, which is why it was very percussive in the beginning. And so the words were always the most important thing. I mean, I still, you know, I had a Harry Cruz last year with Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth. I mean, it's not like I've stopped music, but I prefer to make music that isn't, that cannot transport live to the stage, like Stinkfist, which, yes, was performed a few times, but I prefer making records that, I just don't make records and tour them. It doesn't interest me. And certain musical formats, I think, work well to be played live, but I have a limited attention span. Harry Cruz did 15 dates and will never play another one.
Right.
Spoken word, because you can alter, because you can be influenced by topical situations, it makes it more spontaneous. Because you can respond to people when they're acting in the fashion which they act when they're drunk and fucked up and looking for someone to beat off on.
Hey, baby.
That was Lydia Lunch in conversation with Martin Aston in 1989, concluding this week's Rocks Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Colleen Murphy. Like her Facebook page, Colleen Cosmo Murphy, and visit classicalbumsundays.com. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rocks Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
It's about the songs first and foremost.
Yeah.
It's always about the music first rather than like, look at me.
Yeah.
You'll never see me go like this. I can tell you, I will never do that.
He's Lucas Hare.
He's Kerry Shale.
And this is a trailer for Is It Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
We talk to interesting people like author Neil Gaiman.
Dylan is always more omnipresent than you believe. Part three of American Gods is called This Moment of the Storm. And of course, it's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall is another way of saying that.
Singer Billy Bragg.
I went to Hammersmith Odeon with Chrissy Hynde, and she totally spoiled the whole evening for me by going backstage beforehand and coming and saying to me, you must come back and say hello to Bob afterwards. He'd love to meet you. So I spent the entire gig thinking to myself, what am I going to say to Bob Dylan that, is, that doesn't sound like, hello, Bob, I really like your records. So I ran away.
Actor David Morrissey.
They're stories. They are, or, you know, you sit there and you think, God, this is taking me on a journey, not just by each track, but each album is such a chapter in a life.
Singer Barb Junger.
And suddenly something in the song, you go, bing, you go, oh yeah, that's today. That's the reality of the quality of his understanding of humanity. That kind of, that really relentless gaze.
The legendary Larry Ratso Sloman.
And that's when I talked to him about Sad Eyed Lady. And I said, you know, Bob, I always wondered, you know, in the chorus you say, my warehouse eyes, my Arabian drums. Do you mean eyes as a verb? Or is there a comma there? Is it two different images? And Sarah goes, yeah, I've always wondered that too. And Bob says, leave me alone, Rats.
Writer David Hepworth.
Honestly, the sweat was dripping off me because I was not getting very far. And you always think, I've got to get some quotes. I've got to get some lines or something. And you, of course, you can't get that out of Bob Dylan. It doesn't work like that. Mm. And the woman from the record company said to him, how's it going, Bob? And he says, I don't know. He keeps asking me questions.
And Dylan Authority, Michael Gray.
What he's doing there, Dylan, is he's breaking through the sort of oleaginous smear of coast-to-coast important American television, and he's busting through that and creating a live event, an authentic moment.
Is it Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
His voice is really warm.
It's just that it ain't got no form.
But it's just like a dead man's last pistol shot, baby.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.